Right. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you, Eli. As Eli mentioned, my name is Joe Grand. I am an electrical engineer, and I focus a lot on product development, analyzing products for security, designing products securely, and also focus on mobile device PDA research and various security product analysis. I like to physically handle products as opposed to the software and networking side of things. So the talk today, as the title says, is about understanding embedded security. It's about how to understand how to properly design your products in a way that will prevent hacker attacks, at least try to prevent as many as possible. So the goals, the main one is to learn the concepts of designing secure hardware, and that's understanding the mindset of the attacker, what types of things the attacker will be looking for, and also to become familiar with current types of attacks and attackers, and also ways to defend yourself against those attacks. So before we can understand how to design security mechanisms into our products, we need to understand some general security concepts. The most important is that nothing is ever 100% secure. And what that means is that given enough time, resources, motivation, if an attacker is very determined, they can break your system, they can break your product. So what we try to do is raise the bar enough to prevent most attacks from happening. So the second concept is understanding that you need to secure your product against a specific threat, because you can't protect against all threats and all possible things, because it's hard to imagine every possible attack scenario. So there's three things we need to understand: what needs to be protected, what areas, whether we have some memory that might contain critical information, why it's being protected, maybe it's sensitive information, corporate information, maybe credit card information, or a specific algorithm. And then we need to also determine who we're protecting against, specific enemies. Are we trying to protect against the script kiddies, the curious kids, or are we trying to protect against government agencies and well-funded attackers? So here's an example of why you need to understand the security mechanisms you're designing into your product before you can actually feel secure about them. What this picture is of a house with a 4-foot-thick titanium door, super secure, solid door. And this man here is explaining how great his security is. But then at the side here, you have an attacker climbing right in through the window, which wasn't protected at all. So this is a perfect case where the man designing the house thought he was secure, but forgot about this other attack vector going through the window. So unless you understand all of the mechanisms you're designing into your product, you could still be insecure even though you think you are secure. Another thing about security concepts is you really need to design security into a product during the development of the product. Trying to add security into a product once it's already been released is extremely difficult. So the first thing is to establish a security policy as a foundation, meaning to define what we previously mentioned, who we're trying to protect against, what areas we want to protect against, and constantly revisit this policy as you're going through your product development. And another thing here is you need to try to minimize the elements in the areas that you need to secure, so you can focus your attention on those areas and not try to protect the entire system, because that might actually bring in some more problems, as we'll see later. Also, the goal, again, is to reduce the risk of an attack to an acceptable level, something that you as a designer or as a company can manage, because it is impossible to eliminate all risk of attack. So what you do want to do is implement layered security, meaning some of the mechanisms that we'll talk about in this presentation today, use a number of those to protect a specific area. That way, if one mechanism has been broken, there's still others to serve as a backup. And also, do not implement unnecessary security mechanisms. And what that means is that each mechanism should support a defined goal. Don't just add a security feature in because a client wants it, or because your boss says it's a good thing or read about it in a magazine. You really need to understand what you're implementing before you implement it. So we're going to look at a little bit about types of attacks against your product and types of attackers before we can actually get into some of the actual security mechanisms. So there's three different types of attacks that I've listed here. The most common is an insider attack, and that's coming from unhappy employees within your company, run-on fraud from manufacturers that are manufacturing your product. So you might have an order for 100,000 units. The manufacturer might then go and produce 25,000 extra and sell them on the black market. And the second type of attack is a lunchtime attack. And what that is an attack that takes place during a small window of opportunity, such as a lunch break or a coffee break. If you have a PDA and you check your coat at a restaurant, an attack could happen during that time. If you leave your authentication token or your cell phone on your office desk when you go to the restroom, when there's a small window of opportunity where an attacker could go take your product or take your device and perform an attack against it without you knowing. And the third type of attack is a focused attack, which sort of comprises everything else, where time, money, resources aren't an issue. It could be a government organization, an academic university, somebody with the main goal of breaking your product no matter what it takes. And that's the hardest type of attack to protect against. As a friend of mine says, the only way to stop an attacker is to think like one. And what that means is you need to get inside the mind of the attacker to try to see how they look at the product, because a lot of times the attacks are different than your design. So attackers here, we have classified into three different groups, depending on their expected abilities and strengths and resources that they might have. First one is clever outsiders. Those are curious kids, college students, script kiddies, people that would usually take advantage of a weakness that's already known, that somebody else has already published. Sometimes they're intelligent, but they usually have a limited knowledge of the system. They might not understand engineering or network security. They'll just run a script or perform something that way. The second type of attacker is the knowledgeable insider, and that would be a professional engineer, a professional security consultant, somebody that has access to a lot of the necessary tools and instruments to attack a product, to analyze a product, somebody that has substantial experience in engineering or in security. And the third type of attacker is coming from the funded organization. Again, government, organized crime, people that have a lot of money, a lot of resources, specialists that have experience in a lot of analysis, a lot of attacks, all the tools available that they need. And again, this is the hardest type of attacker to protect against. So there's four different ways that an attacker could gain access to your product in order to attack. Probably the most common is the purchase, when the attacker will just buy the product from a store. If they don't want to be discovered, they'll pay in cash, and can then go and analyze the product in their home or in their laboratory without any chance of detection. And the second type is evaluation, where the attacker would rent or borrow the product. There are a number of companies where you can rent expensive networking equipment, routers, cryptographic accelerators, things that might cost $10,000, so million yen. Something that for most people would not want to just buy, so they'll rent it. The problem with renting is the attacker needs to be careful not to physically damage the device in any way, because once they're done with the attack, they'll need to return it to the place where they rented it from. The third type of way to access a product is an active access, meaning the product is in operation. That could be a network router, maybe a cell phone, an authentication token, something that the user is using all the time. So the attacker has a large risk of possibly being detected if they somehow damage the product, such as crashing the machine by accident or somehow disrupting a network in the process. And the final way to access the product is through remote access. So that would be something that most network security professionals are familiar with. Meaning that the attacker has no physical access to the product at all. Everything they're doing is over the internet through wireless. The attacks are launched remotely. And in that case, the attackers don't need access to special tools and things that we talk about in this presentation. And they can also easily mask their location, so it's harder for them to be detected. So there's four different types of threat vectors. These are extremely high level, and there's many different types under these. But there's four different things that an attacker could do to your product or against your product, and it usually falls under one of these categories. The first one is interception or eavesdropping. And what that means is gaining access to information of your product, to user data, to passwords, cryptographic keys, any information without opening the actual product. The second step is interruption or fault generation, where an attacker would prevent the product from functioning normally, such as a denial of service attack. Possibly physically destructing a hardware device. The third vector is modification, meaning that would be a physically invasive tampering of a product. So where an attacker would open your product, modify the circuitry in some way, add components, read data from memory. That's usually the most common type of hardware-based attack that we need to protect against. And the final vector is fabrication, which would be creating counterfeit data in a product, whether that's adding user credentials to clone an authentication token, or to have a man-in-the-middle attack between two network points. So there are four goals of attacks that we'll talk about before we get into actual design mechanisms. The first goal of an attack is usually for competition or for cloning. And what that means is that it's usually an attacker trying to gain an advantage in the marketplace by copying your product or retrieving some sort of proprietary intellectual property, something that you have designed that they want to steal to make a knockoff, a cheaper product. The second goal is theft of service, and that would be obtaining a service for free that normally costs money. Cable television, cellular phones, any sort of subscription services, bypassing copy protection, an extremely common goal. The third is user authentication or spoofing, and what that is forging a user's identity in order to gain access to a system, whether you're using biometrics, one-time password generator, smart cards, modifying those in some way to gain access. And the final goal is privilege escalation, gaining root on a system, unlocking some sort of undocumented features within a product, whether it's a development mode, a debug mode, taking advantage of undocumented features to retrieve data. So when we talk about secure hardware, and you hear secure hardware and embedded security being used, what that usually refers to are physical anti-tamper mechanisms, which is the primary area for physical security. So we're going to look at a few of the different groups within the anti-tamper mechanisms and then start looking at product-specific ideas. So the goal of implementing anti-tamper mechanisms is to attempt to prevent unauthorized physical access or electronic attacks against the product, which again is most effectively used in layers, so you have backup solutions. It makes it a lot more difficult for an attacker to get through to your system. And the problem with any of the tamper mechanisms is that they can usually be bypassed if the attacker knows what they are. So if an attacker can go and buy your product, maybe use one with the sole purpose of opening up and breaking to see what mechanisms are in there, then they might be able to find out what mechanisms you're using and then bypass those. So there are four different groups of anti-tamper mechanisms. The first one is tamper resistance, and what those are used for is mainly to make tampering more difficult. It might not necessarily stop the attacker, but it might make it hard enough where they might get bored and go try to attack an easier product. And those who are familiar with WEF and 802.11 and wireless networks is using WEF could be considered tamper resistance, where if there's still problems with it, but if an attacker finds a wireless network that uses the encryption and then finds one that doesn't use the encryption, they'll attack the one that doesn't have encryption at all. So that's how you can think about that. And some examples there would be one-way screws, which we do look at later, and some epoxy encapsulation. So the second group of mechanism is tamper evidence, and those are features that ensure that there's some sort of visible physical evidence left behind by a tampering. So it would be obvious if somebody had modified your cell phone or somebody had tried to retrieve data from something using a tamper evidence mechanism. The problem there is that the tamper evidence features are only successful if there's a process in place to check for deformity. So if an attacker had a product in their laboratory and nobody could see that he had broken a seal or removed some tape, it doesn't do any good. It's only good if there's a process in place, maybe if there's a security guard at the door that looks at your smart card every day or that looks at your PDA every day to make sure that it hasn't been tampered with. third type of mechanism is tamper detection. And what that does is will enable the hardware device to be aware of tampering. There's a number of different things that we can do. Using switches is the most basic, which would be to detect the opening a device of the device or maybe breaching a specific defined area of the circuitry that we're trying to protect. Another type would be sensors to detect any sort of operational or environmental change, whether that's a temperature fluctuation, a voltage fluctuation, an attacker trying to change power supply voltages to induce some sort of failure. And then there's also some circuitry features that you can use to detect a puncture or break against a specific area. And we get into details of some of these in some of the later slides. And the final group is tamper response. And what that is actual countermeasures or actions taken upon detection of tampering. So you'd use a tamper detection sensor or switch to detect the attack, and then you'd respond in some way. Usually what that is would be to erase memory. If there's an area that contains cryptographic keys or some sort of data that you don't want an attacker to know about, you immediately erase memory. Or you could also just shut down or disable the device in some way. And then this one resource I have at the bottom provides a lot of different attack types and countermeasures against those, so it's a good resource. And also in the back of the presentation, I have a number of resources for further learning on your own. So now we'll get into some actual design solutions and attacks. We break this into two different sections. First is the enclosure and the mechanical, which is the physical case of the device. And then we'll look at the circuit board level once the attacker has opened the device. So the first is the product housing. And the goal for most attackers at first is to open the product in order to get access to the circuitry. And currently with most products out there, it's usually as easy as just loosening some screws, using a knife to pry open the device. It really doesn't make it difficult at all for an attacker to gain access. And on this slide, we actually have some pictures. This top one is opening the Apple iPod, just using a standard screwdriver to pry open the side. What that will allow you to do is replace the battery by yourself, which Apple usually charges a lot of money for, and also just to perform various hacks on your own. Another example down here is a USB authentication token used to prove you are who you say you are when you log into a network. And in this case, this is actually sold as a security product, and all we had to do to get access to it was use a knife right along the edge and take the circuit board right out. And then from there, we can perform other attacks on it. So there's a number of things that we can do from a design point of view to protect against these simple types of things. And the first is to use a sealed or a molded housing, using a high melting point glue or possibly ultrasonic welding to create a one-piece shell that can't be opened once it's been sealed. The picture down here, which is hard to see, is also another USB token that was properly sealed. So the only way to get access to it using a knife would be to physically destroy it. And then it would be obvious that an attack has taken place. And the one problem with using a sealed housing is to consider service issues. If you need to maintain your product, the problem there is that if a legitimate user can open the device, such as a maintenance person, so can an attacker. So that's one of the things where you need to weigh your risk between user accessibility and ease of use in manufacturing, and then security. So using security bits and one-way screws is another way to make it more difficult for an attacker to get access to your circuitry and to open up the product. There are a few examples that are actually used in Nintendo video game systems and Sega video game systems. The problem there is these are specially shaped security bits that we see down here that aren't standard screws. The problem is you can still buy the bits to open these devices online and at many stores. So using the security bits might not help, but a one-way screw, which is meant to only be tightened and not be loosened, will again make it more difficult. And in that case, there are no special bits available, so the attacker would have to physically damage those screws in order to open the device. Looking at the external interfaces is another area that we need to protect against attacks. And what these are is usually connects the product to the outside world, whether it's a hot sync connection on a POM PDA, whether it's an interface for your mobile phone to your PC. A lot of times the external interfaces are also used for manufacturing testing, for field programming, things that a normal end user might not use, but that could be taken advantage of by an attacker. And examples of external interfaces, RS-232, USB, JTAG is one that we look at that's especially a problem because it's used for manufacturing and extremely hard to remove, but it gives an attacker complete access to your product. And two pictures we have here. This first one is a RSA Secure ID authentication token that on the back, a little sticker protects these five test points that are used for programming. So that's a possible attack vector there that an attacker could take advantage of. And the second picture is a Nokia 3360 cell phone, which is available in the United States. And there, again, are five test points here used for programming that's hidden behind the battery cover. So all the attacker has to do is remove the battery, and they have access to those pins. So any time where there is an interface available or that an attacker discovers will likely be used or monitored by an attacker to try to determine some sort of information. And one example we do have is the Palm OS system password, which is sent in an encoded form over the external interface that can be decoded, and you can figure out what the actual password is. And that's documented in another one of my papers. So when you are using an external interface, make sure that only publicly known information is passed. So if an attacker does monitor that interface, they won't discover anything that isn't already known. The other thing is to encrypt, if you have to, encrypt any components that you do transmit over the wire, so passwords, sensitive information, encrypt those in some way. So if an attacker does monitor the information, they still can't use it. Also, don't just hide the interface because it will be easily discovered by an attacker. As you saw in the two previous pictures, the interface was just hidden by a sticker or behind a battery, something extremely obvious. So don't use any sorts of connectors or other hidden access doors, stickers, things like that, that the attacker will easily be able to discover. One common attack against external interfaces of any type is for an attacker to send a bad packet, an intentionally malformed packet, to try to get the device to crash in some way, or maybe to fail in a way that would send critical information to the user. So when you're designing the firmware to handle the interface and handle the protocols, make sure you protect against that. If you can, and this is hard to do, especially if the product has already been developed, physically remove all of the diagnostic information, the debug information, any sort of backdoor interfaces that are there. Remove those from production units, units that go out to actual users and actual consumers. And one problem I see a lot is there are diagnostic modes and debug modes available. They're just undocumented in products. So it only takes one attacker to find out what the interface is and how it works for the system to be broken. So hiding it won't do. And the problem is that it's really difficult to do this because if you just cut some traces on the board to remove that interface, maybe remove resistors, which could be repaired by an attacker, really the only recommended way to remove the diagnostic information is to have two separate products, one for development and programming for special clients, and then one unit for the rest of the users, similar to Microsoft's Xbox. There's an Xbox development unit for video game developers, and then there's the Xbox commercial unit for users. And there's two more examples of how you attacks against external interfaces because the external interfaces weren't properly protected. Another thing that's common using external interfaces is field programmability, which would be to update firmware, patch your system by the end user, which is common if you go to the Linksys website to upgrade your wireless access point. Firmware images are there. You download the firmware image, load it onto your device. And that's a major problem if you are implementing security in your product because an attacker could load unauthorized types of firmware onto your device. So the main thing here is not to release firmware on your website that could be disassembled and analyzed by the attacker. They might not even need access to the product. And you can still release it to trusted clients and to registered users and things like that, but you don't need to leave it publicly available for the entire world to see. And using code signing or hashes to verify the integrity of the firmware, to verify that your version of the firmware matches what the client has actually received, so nobody has changed that data in the middle somewhere, will also help against attacks. And then if you can, completely encrypt the firmware images, possibly sharing keys with clients and with special users. So now we'll look at some circuit board level attacks. And now we'll assume that the attacker has opened your product and has access to the circuit board. So we can look at different things that they'll do to attack your product and then how we can protect against that. And there's a number of different things we'll look at. The first is access to components. What the attacker will typically do at first is reverse engineer the product in enough for them to figure out how the product works and how the devices communicate with each other. So giving an attacker easy access to all your components makes it easy for the attacker to put together a roadmap of how things go together. So what you want to do is make the sensitive components difficult to access, things like the microprocessor, your memory, programmable logic, areas that might store information that the attacker would want. Hiding those in some way, making them difficult to access without specialized equipment, will turn off a lot of the curious attackers in non-determined attackers. And the next thing you can do is remove the identifiers and markings from your integrated circuits. Because an attacker a lot of times will look at the part numbers on the devices, find the data sheets on a website somewhere, and try to figure out exactly how things work. So there's a number of ways to do that, whether you do it in-house during manufacturing using a brush or a sander. You can also send it out to a third-party company that performs that type of service. And if you do use a third party for that, be sure to send them devices that are not programmed. That way you remove the risk of that third party possibly reading your firmware, reading information out of the device without your permission. So some more things you can do to prevent easy access is to use advanced packaging types. Package types that are difficult to probe with standard tools, with tools that a college student might have. It will make it more difficult. Something like a BGA, a ball grid array, which has all of the pins of the device actually underneath the device instead of sticking out. And the second thing you can do is use a chip-on-board design, which is a picture up here, which is basically the actual die of the integrated circuit mounted right onto the board and covered with epoxy. So if an attacker needed to, it would make it a lot harder for the attacker to probe the device because they don't have pins to connect to. They'll have to remove the epoxy, possibly determining the die or damaging the die in the process. And then the final thing you could do, which is more expensive, is using a chip inboard, which is similar to the chip onboard, except the die is actually mounted inside of the circuit board. So another common thing to do is cover critical components with epoxy or with glue, some way that makes it harder for the attacker to physically get access to the pins. And the problem, though, with using epoxy is that it wasn't designed specifically for security purposes, meaning it can be removed with chemicals or with special tools. It just makes it a lot harder. And we have two examples down here. This is another, both of these are USB authentication tokens, some epoxy right over the microprocessor here. But for an attacker, all they have to do is scrape off with a knife the sides, and they can get access to the pins. So it doesn't really protect the device that much. And the second picture is actually a little better. This is another token that was completely filled with epoxy, the entire device. So once you opened it, you'd basically probably damage the device as you're opening it up to gain access to the circuitry. As you can see, there's lots of, I used a knife and scraped everything. So another area to be concerned with is interference, electrical interference, electrostatic discharge, radio interference, things that are common for all electrical devices. And the problem with EMI, with electromagnetic interference, is that that can be monitored and possibly used by an attacker to determine some sort of information. The first instance of this that was actually publicly made available was monitoring data on a computer monitor from far away, measuring the high voltage fluctuations of the monitor. So the attacker could recreate what was on that user's screen on their own screen. You can also use that same type of theory on a smart card to retrieve cryptographic keys from the device. Devices are also susceptible to RF or electrostatic discharge. which could intentionally be used by an attacker to cause a failure in your product. So there's a few ways that we can protect ourselves here against some of these attacks. The first is to install EMI shielding, which will decrease the emissions from the device and also increase the immunity protected against stray noise. And that can be done using specialized coatings, tapes, housings that are properly grounded, properly shielded. And if you are using EMI shielding, be aware of any temperature changes, any thermal changes that it might make to your product, especially if you're fitting it into a product that already exists. Because it does get hotter, heat can escape as well. And another thing is to protect against electrostatic discharge on any interface that's accessible to the user, any I/O lines. Such as keypads, buttons, displays, by using clamping diodes, TVS devices, transient voltage suppressors, common devices that are available from a number of different companies. We'll then prevent an attacker from using electrostatic discharge to try to damage your product or cause it to do something that it wasn't intended to do. Also, when you're designing your circuit board, use proper power and ground claims to reduce interference. Also, place your power supply circuitry as close as you can to the power input of the device, because the power supply circuitry is typically the most noisy, so keeping that into one area will make the rest of your product a lot cleaner. Also, remove unnecessary test points from your board. Aside from an attacker trying to probe those test points and figure out what they are, test points, especially through-hole, will allow noise to propagate through your board. And the last thing is any unused pins you have on your device, any unused input-output pins or modules that aren't used in your microprocessor should be removed or disabled or set to a state where they don't fluctuate, which could induce noise. When you are designing your circuit board, there's a few things you can do to, again, make it more difficult for an attacker, though it won't stop them completely. You can use confusing trace paths of signals to prevent easy reverse engineering. And you can do that by hiding traces on inner board layers that aren't accessible from the top or the bottom of the circuit board. The problem of doing this is a lot of times you'll introduce more noise, especially in a high-speed circuit, if there's too much crosstalk between connections. And you can also use buried vias, which connect two or more inner layers together, but doesn't get access to the top or the bottom layer. So it can't be seen from either side of the board, making it harder for an attacker to actually get access to those traces. And one example of why you should hide your critical traces, your address buses, data buses, between memory and the microprocessor and things like that is this example we have here. And this is a picture from Bunny Huang, who did a lot of research at Massachusetts Institute of Technology on the Xbox and security of the Microsoft's Xbox. What he discovered is a number of the bus lines were accessible on the circuit board. He could monitor those, figure out the encryption keys to a protected bootloader, and load unauthorized games onto the system. So Microsoft could easily have avoided this by hiding all of those layers for all of those traces on a layer that's inaccessible to the user. Moving on to some memory and programmable logic. Currently, most memory that's available is insecure. There are no security features associated with the devices. A lot of them can be read with a standard device programmer, a common tool in any design firm and any engineering firm. And serial EEPROMs, electrically erasable devices, can also be read in circuit, so you don't even need to remove the device from the board in order to read information out of it. And there's an example of an attack on that. Now, one problem that we need to be aware of with memory is that it's difficult to completely erase data from RAM and from other sorts of non-volatile memory, such as flash. Meaning that if you do have cryptographic keys or other sorts of data that you try to erase, remnants of that data may still exist, and an attacker might be able to retrieve that data even after the power has been removed. And we'll get into a solution on how to fix that. So for field programmable gate arrays, programmable logic, SRAM-based devices are the most vulnerable because the configuration data needs to be loaded from an external memory device every time the system is powered up. So all the attacker has to do is monitor the bit stream, the communication between the external memory, which is usually a serial EEPROM, and the FPGA, retrieve all of the all of your intellectual property or whatever code is loaded into the FPGA. So some protection methods that we can use. The first thing is to protect against I/O scan attacks, which an attacker would cycle through all possible combinations of inputs to determine what the outputs are, to figure out how the actual programmable logic is working. So to protect against that, we can try to use unused pins of the programmable logic to detect probing, to act as a tamper detection feature. And then once we do detect probing, we can then perform some sort of action against that. Some devices, although they're not completely secure, do have security fuses and boot block protection to protect certain specified areas of memory. So it's recommended to use these features if they exist in your memory device. One example of an attack against the security bit is with a microchip PIC device that basically you can change the power on a certain pin that will remove the security bit and would then allow an attacker to completely read all of the firmware and all of the data out of the device, even though it was supposed to be protected. So also, because it is hard to completely erase data from memory, what you can do is limit the amount of time that critical data is stored in the same area of memory. So if you have a cryptographic key, move it around to different locations or flip the bits so the gates don't keep the same charge all the time. If you are using a state machine within your programmable logic, make sure that all conditions are covered, all defaults are covered. So if the attacker tries to get your device into an unintended mode, the system will know, and it won't crash or won't do something unexpected. So some advanced attacks against memory aren't used that much yet because some of the materials and tools are still hard to get for most attackers. But we are seeing more and more of this, and it's something that we need to try to protect against, which is basically consisting of removing the lid from a device and analyzing the actual die of the integrated circuit. So an attacker would do this to visually recreate contents of the memory, whether you want to obtain a cryptographic key or read all of the firmware out of it, or also you can modify the die in some way, possibly to remove a security bit or re-enable a feature. And there's a number of tools that are available that somebody could use to do this. Chip decappers remove the top of the device automatically. Electron microscopes, various types of things you can do. And there are some pictures here. This is a close-up of an EEPROM memory device with the silicon die that you can see. The middle picture is a close-up of a ROM-based device, a read-only device programmed only once. Extreme close-up using a scanning electron microscope, and you can actually see the fuses either connected or unconnected, each representing a 1 or a 0 within a memory area. And then the third picture, which is hard to see, is an actual cut using a focused ion beam machine to cut a specific trace on the actual die. And this is an extreme magnification. So the only way to really currently protect against these types of attacks is to use some of the tamper, the anti-tamper features such as epoxy, making it difficult for the attacker to get access to the die. Because once they have access to it, there's a number of things they can do, and we can't protect against that. So the power supply of your device is also another area where an attacker might try to take advantage of things. And what we need to do is define the minimum and the maximum operating limits of the device so an attacker can't try to vary the power to cause some sort of problem like they did with the microchip PIC to remove the security bit. So what we can do is use standard devices, comparators, watchdogs, supervisory circuitry to monitor the power supply and make sure it's within a defined range. And also, don't rely on the end user of the product to always supply the correct voltage. This would mean attackers and also legitimate users that might accidentally plug in the wrong power supply. So in that case, you can use a linear regulator, a DC to DC converter, standard power supply circuitry. And of course, if the attacker has access to the board at this point, they can bypass any of that circuitry and then modify or change the power supply voltages and things like that. But at least it protects it a little bit. There are two different ways that an attacker can take advantage of power supply problems. The first is simple power analysis, where the attacker is directly observing power consumption of the device. And basically, what the attacker can do is identify certain functions, cryptographic functions, certain operation of the device, because power consumption will vary depending on the computational power required by the microprocessor, for example. And the second type of analysis or attack is known as differential power analysis, which is based on simple power analysis but uses mathematical methods to determine more secret information, more information about a device. And one of the final areas that we look at the circuit board level are related to cryptographic processors and encryption algorithms. So the first thing to remember is that the strength of cryptography relies on the secrecy of the key, how the crypto key is stored, not the algorithm. So one thing that I do say is don't create your own algorithms. Use an algorithm that has been tested by cryptographers, that has been verified, something you know is safe. Most of the time when a vendor creates their own encryption algorithm, they're not cryptographers. They don't understand how somebody would break the algorithm, and eventually somebody breaks the algorithm. So also, it's not safe to assume that just because you use a large key size that your product will be secure. This is something you see a lot with security product vendors saying they have a 1,024-bit key, they have a 2,048-bit key, which really doesn't mean anything if the algorithm isn't secure, if they don't use an actual good cryptographic algorithm, or if they implement the algorithm improperly in some way, then the key won't matter. So one thing that you can't see on this slide is that you should test any implementations of cryptography on your device in your lab first when you're designing it. Try to break the encryption on your own. Have other colleagues try to break that encryption, because it's better if you do find a weakness, you can fix it before you release the product. So if you do have cryptographic functionality in your device, one thing you can do to make it harder for attackers to determine information is to move all of the functionality from firmware, where it's usually operating in firmware, in software, into your programmable logic device. Move it into hardware. And the reason that we should do that is, aside from getting the increased performance of running out of hardware, which is faster, it's also harder to probe than ROM devices, which is where the firmware would be located. And as you saw from our previous picture, it's easy to magnify a ROM device and see the actual gates if they're 1 or 0 and recreate data. Another solution is to use a secure cryptographic coprocessor, which are commercial devices that are available that are specifically used for cryptographic operations, for encryption purposes. And some of those devices have some of the tamper response features that we looked at earlier, also some user authentication, and they also act as general purpose processors, so you can use them for other functionality of your device. So to wrap up some of what we had talked about, the most important thing about designing secure products, about understanding embedded security, is to the three things we looked at is determining what to protect, what areas you want to protect in your device, why you are protecting it. So what data are you trying to protect? Is it critical encryption keys? Is it financial data? Is it a specific algorithm that your company has designed? We need to understand the reasons for that. And then you also need to understand who you're protecting against. Is it the curious high school student or is it the advanced government institution? Because no one solution fits everyone. Every product will have different reasons for designing security, and every product will have different mechanisms that they use to protect against attacks. Also, do not release the product first with a plan to add security to it later. It usually doesn't happen because of financial issues, marketing issues. A lot of times a company will say, well, the product is out there, we're making money, why should we now make it secure? And one other thing, in that case, if you do release a secure version of the product later, the problem there is you need to make sure that the attacker can't look at the original insecure version and figure out how things operate and then bypass some of your security mechanisms in your new secure model. Another important thing is to be aware of the latest attack methodologies that are out there. What sorts of attacks are people doing against hardware? How can you protect yourself? Keep up to date on attacks. So, sort of like the antivirus world, it's a cat and mouse game. It's a race between the attackers and the designers. Also, as your design is in progress for your product, allocate some time again to analyze the product. Try to break the security within your laboratory. And then finally is learn from mistakes. So look at some previous attacks that we talked about in these slides. Learn from history and see how other classes of attacks have taken place, and then we can protect against those a little better. So at the end of the presentation, I have a number of references for various attacks, and you can also feel free to email me if you have questions, and we can open up for questions and answers now. And you can also ask your questions in Japanese, and I'll listen here. All right. There's a wide range of products and tools that are out there. For a basic hardware hacking attack type of laboratory that you might want within your organization might cost maybe $500 US or $1,000 US to buy some of the basic tools and equipment. Depending on how complicated you want to get, you might spend $25,000 US, $50,000 US. I actually do have a list of some of the tools that you can use to start analyzing some of your products. It's in a different presentation, so I'll load that up right now. You can be very serious for $50,000. Yeah. It is cheap. I mean, there are some tools that are out there, some of the X-ray machines, the scanning electron microscopes, that are in the hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars. Most organizations won't buy those, but they'll use somebody else's. And that's more of just a networking thing, is I don't have my own, but I know people in a company that have it that will let me use it whenever I want. So that's that type of thing. And there is always eBay, and a lot of measurement tools, a lot of test tools show up on eBay for very cheap prices. And that's a factor because of the .com boom and then the dot-com crash in the United States, a lot of companies are trying to get rid of their equipment as quickly as possible. Is there any other questions while I pull up some of the lists of tools? Well, in my specific book, we don't look much at breaking security mechanisms because the laws vary between countries so much. But from what I've seen, the Xbox had decent security until Bunny found out the problems with the bootloader, with the encrypted bootloader. PlayStation 2 had also had some authentication security. But that could be bypassed, and that's actually something that we talk about in my book, is bypassing the security of that using memory cards. So you can run your own games, and not pirated games, but your own homebrew games that you create. And then the GameCube, also, I don't recall offhand what security was there, but I don't think there was much, and it was easily bypassable, but we didn't publish that information in the book. Clever security. Right. Let me think about that one for a second. Off the top of my head, I can't think of anything that I ever saw and said, wow, they're doing it right. Because there's always been a problem somewhere. I really can't think of anything that's been really, really good. Looks like Eli has a... So, I guess before another question, to answer part of Jeff's question, is some of the tools that you can use for your basic hardware analysis laboratory. And these slides are from a presentation at DEF CON last year in Las Vegas that are available on my website. So you can download that for this list. But you typically have basic electronic laboratory types of things, screwdrivers, tool, Dremel tool, a drill, protective gear. Then this sort of increases in cost and in functionality. Still basic mechanical tools for some of the physical probing of the device. Some more tools. And then we get into some of the actual electronic tools that you might want to use. A microscope, multimeters, power supplies, device programmers, PC board, etching to create your own circuit boards quickly and easily for your circuitry. And an oscilloscope. There's also, you can't see on this slide, is a logic analyzer, which will allow you to analyze a number of digital buses at the same time. So if you're looking at a communication interface, you can use a logic analyzer. And those you can get for probably the oscilloscope and the logic analyzer each for maybe $500 to $2,500 U.S. used. And the thing about a lot of these electronics tools is that even if they're 20 years old, they're still just as good as some of the newer ones with just a few less features. The oscilloscope I use is from 1986, and the logic analyzer I use is from 1990, and it's been fine for everything I've needed them for.
My question for you, Joe, is do you think there are times and instances where a hardware manufacturer would be an advantage to make their hardware easier? necessarily, I would imagine, bad for Linksys to have their hardware being modified in ways that would really that. Can you talk about why this might be a good idea?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great question, and the security of a product really comes from what the product is being used for. If you have a video game system, for example, you might want it to be easily programmable and easily hackable for people to buy it. If you have a security product, like a router or an access point or a smart card, then your security might be a little more serious, or a cell phone or a BlackBerry device and things like that. So the only time where there are definitely uses where systems should be designed open, and that really comes with marketing and you know the decisions of the company. But one thing that comes to mind right away is a Korean company called GamePark. And they make a console called the GP32, which is a handheld unit. And it's completely open. There's thousands of hobbyists out there that are modifying the device, writing games for the device, doing all of these things. And that's really what made the company survive, is all of these hobbyists. If they had locked down their system and not prevented anybody from using it, they would have failed because they were too small. Another example is the Apple IIe. From the early 80s, late 70s. That system was totally open for hobbyists and for hackers, and that's really what gave Apple their name, because people would create their own hardware expansion boards and write their own software. And that's something that really helped the entire computer industry thrive. If they had locked that down and prevented people from developing their own hardware, sort of like IBM tried to do, might be a different world right now. So there are advantages. It just depends on what the end purpose of the product is, because you do see a lot of hobbyists trying to load Linux onto just about everything available, not necessarily to break security, but just to do it because they can. Are there any other questions? I would say that you want to incorporate security as soon as you start coming up with a concept for a product. It's one of those things where, as you're defining the features of your product, you would also start to define security at that point. Because if you're at the ground level and you're defining your product, it makes it easier to say what areas we need to protect. And adding security mechanisms into the product instead of trying to use band-aids and glue to fix it later. Did that answer? Another question? I haven't seen any attacks out there or any ways to retrieve data from the devices, but the first thing that comes to mind is using standard forensic analysis types of tools and standard acquisition tools to gain physical access to the hard drive and image the hard drive that way. With a lot of those digital copy machines, there probably are administration interfaces that could be used. So maintenance or service personnel could go to configure the device and to retrieve data, and one of those areas could probably be used. I don't know of any offhand. I'm just sort of guessing. But that is a good point, is that a lot of devices out there now have hard drives for printers that would just store all sorts of, for printers and for copiers, store all of the data that's on there that could be potentially really damaging if an attacker could get access to that. And actually one example of a printer that also served as a print server, I think it was a Hewlett-Packard device a few years ago, somebody found a way to use SNMP to configure the printer and basically turn the printer into a network-enabled FTP server so people could connect to the device and store pirated software on somebody's printer and they would never know. So sort of an interesting side attack against using a product with hard drives. For a lot of the devices that are out there now that do have protection for media distribution and for copyrights, they are all software-based, so the first thing that comes to mind is that you can't really have a secure software application or secure program without having a secure hardware base, because even if the software protection works, a user could still access the hardware physically and then possibly modify the data, change the credentials in order to copy the data or to load copyrighted data onto the device. I don't know of any devices out there yet that are implementing any sort of hardware protection at this point, but I think it's only a matter of time because the companies behind these products, major media distribution and movie industry, have a lot of money, and they're trying to protect against that. My personal opinion on the digital rights management and distribution, protecting against that type of thing, is I wish they didn't have to do it in hardware or in products. The VCR tape players didn't harm the industry and still allowed people to copy tapes if they wanted to, but people still went out and purchased the music as well. So I don't necessarily agree with it, and I think it will be a matter of time until there are hardware mechanisms in there. Do you mean the life cycle as far as how long typically would it take for an attacker to attack your product once it's been released, or? Okay. I would say any cool, interesting product that's released, it could take as quickly as a day, it could take as long as a few months, or never. It depends on how curious somebody is. And for the most part, there's usually one person somewhere will look at one product somewhere along the way. So it's hard to say. How long for Bunny and his Xbox work? I think that took him a few months of solid engineering work to figure out how things worked or how to break the security there. For more simple products, it might be a day, but I'd say typically maybe a month or two if people are looking at products or looking at the product on a daily basis. And that's something we haven't seen too much in the States yet is a lot of network-enabled home appliances and things like that, which eventually I think will happen. But there are a number of products that have been hacked right away. Another example I just thought of is a digital camera that's available in the United States as a disposable digital camera, which is meant to, you'd pay $10, use the camera, and then give it to the camera shop to give you your digital images. But somebody found a way to just open up the camera. A programming port was available right on the circuit board, and then they could dump their pictures onto their home computer and reuse the device. So something where there's an actual practical purpose for the hack, it happened right away. For something a little more obscure, it might take longer. The good thing is that recently a lot of companies have started to take security seriously, and they have started to design security into their products, but that's only been in the last probably year. Before that, the main problem is a lot of the product designers, the electrical engineers, aren't familiar with computer security because they've been two separate areas. So somebody like me who has insight into both would look at a product and easily say, here are problems. But in general, the engineering community doesn't understand the problems, which is why conferences like this are important, to really get people aware of that, because a lot of times they weren't even aware of it in the first place. So definitely recently there's been companies that are starting to implement security, specifically in cellular phones, two-way pagers, consumer devices that are available in the millions of units. And then obviously you still have the video game systems that are concerned with pirated games is another area that's really starting to take off. That basically every company now needs to, at least they think they need to, protect against pirated software. So there is a trend towards more secure devices and people implementing security, but it's still a long and hard battle to try to educate lots of people about it and really get things moving in the right direction. sort of took some getting used to
listening
to this and then waiting.
I noticed you're the first speaker that I noticed today.
To wait.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's because there was times when I thought I was speaking slowly, and she it took a while for her to catch up.
Right.
So, I
think that was okay.
Yeah.
It's challenging to do it.
It's
cool.
Your lock is new.
Yeah.
There's no one?
Well, in case I have to go somewhere.
Is that a circular?
Yeah, it's totally weak, but...
I got a big pen. It's all good.
Yeah. I figure if I'm at a security conference, I should at least try to to secure it.
I actually got a question. So I suppose a PDA like BlackBerry or OpenPC is supposed to be data on it. How trivial is it to dump out the memory from the file system from the device?
PocketPC is extremely useful. On my website, I have another presentation that talks about that.
Okay.
PocketPC, Palm devices, Scion, Symbian, those are all really easy to retrieve data from.
Those I got no protection at all.
There's
basically none. Yeah.
A product called PDA Protect.
Yeah. Yeah, there's PDA Protect and a few third-party applications that you could load onto devices to encrypt certain data.
But that's all software,
right? And so chances are they're storing the keys somewhere.
Yeah,
for BlackBerry, that's the only one I know of that actually has a number of security features in place. I've done some hardware-related research with them, so I'm sort of bound by their NDA.
Right.
But they're one that's, if you use their security features, as far as I know, it's really difficult to retrieve data from. But if you just store data without their security features, it can easily be retrieved. There's one tool that's called PDA Seizure, which is a forensic tool that can retrieve memory from a lot of the devices, PocketPC, Palm. If you go to my website, there is one of that. That's an interface for a personal information manager thing, right? Sidekick is.
It's basically a PIM and a phone
right.
all together.
Yeah. Okay.
And it
looks open. Oh, okay. I didn't realize it was an actual device. Do you know what operating system it runs on? Or is it?
It's their own.
Okay. Yeah, I haven't heard anything about them, but I would assume that there's probably not any sort of real protection.
I have no idea what that is. And you can go to danger.com to read about it.
Oh, okay. I'll check that out.
Yeah, they're a startup. They built the device, and the way they make money is they lease. They license the design to telecom companies who then have them made for customers. So, let's see. What's the German company? T-Mobile.
Okay.
Is selling in the U.S.
Right.
And so they did their own OS, and then they have a Java API.
Okay.
Big applications on it. And everything, I would take the first way to attack it through software because everything that goes on it.
Right. Well, the thing with using Java is there is at least some sort of abstraction between user apps and everything.
Yeah.
So, being a hardware guy, the first thing I do is open the device, but a lot of times you can't do that.
Yeah.
Just throw it away.
Not in here. Should I write it here? Okay. It just went to press 2 weeks ago, so it should be out in a few weeks in English. And then there should be, we're hoping to have a Japanese version, but it might take 6 months or a year or something. Singer's Publishing is the publisher. What's that?
he means a military product.
Oh. Yeah. I haven't looked at any.
I think the price is interesting. It looks kind of secure, at least from the outside, are the LSI buttons.
Oh, yeah. I've done some work with those.
Yeah?
Yeah. There's on my website, there's... I worked with one which was the DS1991A, I think, which was... It had some password protection for three different areas. Mm-hmm. I broke that through like a dictionary attack type of thing.
Okay.
But, yeah, for the most part, those things are really physically secure,
yeah.
And, like, their crypto iButton, like the Java one,
right,
is really cool.
The Java one.
That's what I have. It's really cool.
Like that, yeah.
And, yeah, people... It's used a lot in, like, Europe, but... It's not as common as I thought it would be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a really cool device, and it actually has tamper features in it, and if you open it, it will erase memory and things like that. It seems like they've actually taken the right step, and they've been around for a few years, and it's like they just haven't... Like, the post office... The post office uses them, U.S. post office, and, like, some other places, but it's really not as widespread as I thought.
Yeah, there are people that I know that are in the U.S. government trying to get them worldwide.
Yeah.
There are, for example, some security situations where they have these cards that you slip in, but you can stick the card in upside down, backwards. There are four ways you can put it in, only one of which works.
Oh.
And so the people who are pushing the iButton say, well,
you need
this. If you need it to work, you may not be able to see. You need something like the iButton, you can just shove in the hole, the way it goes.
Exactly. That's like, I actually implemented the iButton into a portable infusion pump that I designed.
Mm-hmm.
And basically all of the medicines would have iButtons on them, and all the nurse would have to do is touch the medicine bag to the pump, so the pump would know what medicines it has, and then warn them if they're mixing medicines or doing something wrong. So, and then there's each nurse would have an iButton to control the pump, so like the patient wouldn't be able to change it and everything. So it was pretty cool.
Yeah, it seems like once you have Java on the device, you can do all sorts of stuff.
Yeah. There are a few devices that are starting to use Java a lot more, like for portable devices and stuff. But it's just a slow mm-hmm. progress, you know, because once hardware is done and someone has everything working, it's so hard for a company to go and change it. So unless they've already implemented Java in it, it's hard for other companies to catch up.
Yeah.
That's why it will take like 5 more years at least until things are, I'd say, more secure all around. So that's sort of job security for me, I guess.
Yeah, about the devices being intentionally not secure.
TRS-80
Model 1.
Okay.
At the motherboard layout and schematic was
that's
in
right.
the user manual.
It was all, yeah. And that
and,
was,
and
yeah.
It was a single, you opened it up just like the picture in the manual.
Right.
I mean, the traces were huge, a single layer, so
right.
you
everything
look
was
at
there.
The hardware.
Yeah, that's sort of a tribute to that type of stuff does work. And that was also the age of home computing.
Yeah, hobbyists.
Where only hobbyists
how
would, yeah, only hobbyists who understood schematics anyway would be buying the computers.
Mm-hmm.
But it is, keeping things open is, I think, extremely important. And that's like a lot of my products. One of them that I've sold a bunch of, I don't even have an enclosure for it. You know, it's just a circuit board with the parts on it. And if somebody wants to hack it, that's fine. Because they're still buying it from me. You know, I'm not losing money.
Well, the question is whether you want to sell a collection of things that work together, so you want to stop someone from competing.
Right.
Or if you want to sell a platform,
right.
you're happy if other people create a reason.
That's the thing,
to buy
is,
that.
Yeah, exactly. And having a platform is, at least from my point of view, a good thing. Yeah, definitely. Because you never know what someone's going to come up with. It might even benefit your product if they come out with something amazing for it.
Interesting.
Cool, thanks. Microwaves, like an actual microwave? Or like a... Probably would erase, maybe erase the drive? Yeah, I haven't heard much about that, other than it would completely destroy the hard drive. But yeah, then you could use some of the shielding to protect against that. Right. Yeah. And depending on the goal, that could be enough.